Hello, everybody. Dave Hodges here. I'm the host of The Common Sense Show. We are the show that is freeing America one enslaved mind at a time. Thank you so much for joining us. And we have a special broadcast today. We have Jeff Gilson on, and this is going to be, a little on the controversial side. The one thing about our guest, though, is I've researched Jeff Gilson, is that he doesn't take sides. He just tells the truth no matter where it falls. And both sides are at risk when Jeff is in the room if they're not telling the truth. And that's one of the things that my research shown me. He is the author of a book called Maggie's Hammer, and he was a speechwriter for Margaret Thatcher. Some people argue the last really good politician in the UK, maybe. But she was, I'll tell you, I'd rather have her there today than what we've got. And he is a major, or was a major operative in the British Conservative Party. And he has uncovered a lot in the American political world. And we're going to talk about a connection between the Epstein scandal and the Russian collusion delusion. And there's other tributaries that run into this as well, too. And, you know, we've touched on some of this on the show. We're going to get to Jeff in just a second. As I let you know, we're coming to you from the Noble Gold Studios. Don't let the banks take your money. Dodd-Frank 2010, UCC Section 8, they can take your money anytime they want. And if they get into crisis, that's exactly what they're going to do. And Noble Gold can help you set things up to where your retirement's not at risk and you've minimized how much assets you have associated with the bank. And they'll redirect you into the way they've redirected me in the past 8 years, multiple times over. I really highly recommend them. Call 877-646-5347, 877-646-5347. And they are the primary sponsor for this show. Jeff, first time guest on the Common Sense Show. Great to have you on. Your credentials are incredible. They're very impressive. And I'm glad to see someone taking on the topics that you're taking on. I've been an avid Trump supporter, but I have said this, you know, to quote Shakespeare, you know, if the heavens may fall, that's okay. Let justice prevail. And that's a paraphrase of Shakespeare. And I don't care where this falls. I want the truth coming out on these topics, no matter where it lands. But anyway, welcome to the show. And as a good point of entry here, where do you think we should start in telling the story?
Well, first of all, Dave, thank you for having me on your show, and thank you to special guests for making the introduction.
Yes.
Very interesting. You can start this in a number of different places. I would say, for the benefit of your listeners, I'm no expert. This is not something into which I wanted to get involved, but a friend of mine died in 1988 in mysterious circumstances. I started asking the right questions in what turned out to be the wrong places. And I followed the trail ever since because it never stops. And this is where we are. I think probably the best place to start is with Epstein and Russiagate. I think that most people paying a stop. This is being recorded, correct?
Yes, yes.
You can go back and edit, correct?
Yes, we prefer not to.
Okay, I'll tell you for why. Because somebody, I'm not sure that you're actually getting me because something's coming in, and I'm trying to get rid of it.
No, we're good, Jeff. We're 5x5.
Okay,
you're coming through strong. Everything is.
I will start that again. The best place to start is actually with Epstein and Russiagate. I think most of your listeners will probably look at the two of these things and say, "Well, wait a minute, Epstein. That's been around for a while. What's the deal that Trump might be in the files? Well, hang on, we know he's in the files. Everyone in New York is in the files." So why is it suddenly back with the fury in the headlines? And Russiagate 2016, there were two inquiries into that. Surely we know what's going on. Okay, if they're back in the news, is there a chance that there's something else going on? And the answer is yes, there is. There is very definitely a power play going on in Washington. And the question is to work out what that power play is. I can help you, Dave, and your listeners wander through the elements. I'll be honest, I'm not sure that anyone really knows what the elements of the power play are.
Okay.
But if I say a phrase like the New World Order, I'm pretty sure that's not something that your listeners are unaware of, other than the fact that there are more than one New World Order. There are several New World Orders. And I think that sort of thing is playing out in Washington at the moment. Is Trump the good guy? Don't know. Is he the bad guy? I don't think there is good and bad. I think there are powerful interests competing for power. I read the other day something which said that the thing with power is people don't like to give it up. And someone said to me, well, in this story, what is the exit strategy? And I said, there is no exit strategy. The people involved are always going to be looking to retain power. If you look at Epstein, you see a reprehensible man and his friends engaging in awful sexual activities. And the problem, Dave, is very many people only look that far. That's bad enough, but maybe there's something going on behind it. If you look at Russiagate, what you see on the surface is the fact that Obama may or may not have instructed intelligence agencies to do a better job of finding collusion between Trump and the Russians and to take it from there. But is there something else going on? Yes, there is. All of it comes back in briefly to arms dealing, money laundering, corrupt intelligence agencies, and primarily the Israeli intelligence agencies and the Russian mob. All of it. Most of what is going on in the headline at the moment is about that. Okay, how do we get there? That's where you start. You have to go back to the 80s. People, why do we have to go back to the 80s? All roads lead back to the 80s. If you want to understand what's going on now, you have to go back to the 80s. And in the 80s, you have to go back to London. And in London, you have to go back to the events that are in my book, Maggie's Hammer. That's why Maggie's Hammer is relevant. Most people see the headline for Maggie's Hammer and they say, this is a book about British intelligence activities in England in the 80s. What's the relevance? Everything is the relevance. Let's look at the 80s. Now, I know this is now 40 some years ago, so it may be secondhand to me. I appreciate it's not secondhand to many listeners. In the 80s, one of the primary geopolitical activities was the long drawn out war between Iran and Iraq. It lasted a decade. A lot of people got killed, but the United Nations had issued an embargo against both countries, and they both needed arms. And the only way they could do it was illegally. Iran bought $80 billion worth of arms illegally, Iraq, $60 billion. And this offered an opportunity to intelligence agencies and governments at the time in the West to make money. And my primary Israeli intelligence source, a gentleman by the name of Ari Ben-Menashe, made it very clear to me. He said, people like you now, the next decade, the 90s, the noughts, you're always going to be looking for an intelligence reason, a military reason. What's going on politically? He said, there is some of that. But the most important thing you have to understand, he said, is that every agency, including in the West, including the agencies I work for in Israel, he said, we all got corrupted. We were all talking about making millions of dollars in profits and kickbacks out of arms. And what's been happening since then is these interests have been protecting those profits and that influence. So in the 80s, you had the West, particularly the United States CIA, Israeli intelligence agencies, selling arms illegally to Iran and Iraq. Other books and authors and probably guests on your show have talked about this Israeli-American connection. But one of the things they miss out in order to truly understand the picture is the British intelligence involvement. Great Britain's intelligence agencies in the 80s were essentially hired out by Margaret Thatcher to be surrogates primarily for the Israelis and the Americans to do things that they couldn't do. For example, we all know that the United States financed the Mujahideen to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan during the 80s. However, the CIA were under an admonition that they could not cross into Afghanistan. They brought the weapons to the border and the British took over. And not many people know that. It was the Brits taking the weapons into Afghanistan
This
with the
is the first
Mujahideen.
time I've ever heard this, yes.
In the Lebanon, where you will know the Marine barracks was blown up. The Americans had come in to be peacekeepers after the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982. The Marine barracks was blown up. The American embassy was under attack. At that time, although there were efforts to try and maintain the peace, there were also covert efforts to rescue hostages that had been taken and to undertake assassinations to gain a foothold, to gain influence in the Lebanon. That wasn't undertaken by the CIA. That was undertaken by the British and so on. So the British formed an important third stool to this arrangement in the 80s. It's important to understand that because most of this came out of London. Why London? Because of the City of London, which is a private corporation and is very underregulated. If listeners want to try and get a picture in their mind of what was the City of London, what is the City of London, think Pirates of the Caribbean, Jack Sparrow, and the East India Company, and that terrible, awful, snotty English person who wanted to capture Jack Sparrow. The East India Company and organizations like it were the financiers behind the British Empire out of London. They were private, and the City of London continued to be private. And the manner in which they employed their money, raised mercenary armies, basically raped foreign countries of their minerals, continues to this day. And if you want to raise it in the 80s and even now, if you want to organize a coup, raise a mercenary army, organize financing for a drug operation or sex trafficking or arms dealing or money laundering, you go to the City of London because it is so underregulated. And in the 80s, London was the center for all of this activity. Now, at the same time, one of the primary agents in the 80s in London was this gentleman called Ari Ben-Menashe. Whole different story about how I came across him, but he was operating out of London. Why the Israelis? Well, all Israel is concerned about is keeping Israel for Israel and the Arabs. 1972, Munich Olympic massacre, when 11, I believe, or 12 Israeli athletes were massacred by the PLO. At that time, the Israeli intelligence agencies split. If I'm moving too fast, Dave, you can just say, I mean, one or two people have said to me before, wow, can you take a breath? Because there's a lot of information we have never heard before. I understand this. 27 years it took of first-hand investigations and research, putting together Maggie Sammer to come up with all of this. It's an incredible story to understand, and there's a lot of moving
Well,
parts.
I'd like to ask you one question.
Yes.
What would motivate the British to be the gopher for the US and Israel?
Well, at the risk of being patronizing, Dad, I'm sorry about taking a sip out of my English teacup, but it was getting a bit dry. When Margaret Thatcher took over in 1979, the socialists in the 70s had essentially bankrupted Great Britain. Little plug, I have a sense of where the politics of your listeners are. They're not, with respect, the same politics as me. I'm a Democrat, and I used to be a Tory in Great Britain. What I am not is a socialist. And anybody who pretends to you that socialism is warm and fuzzy, and particularly if you call it something like democratic socialism, do not believe them. Socialism is not warm and fuzzy. It ends up bankrupting your country every time. When Margaret Thatcher took over in 1979, the public purse was bankrupt. We had huge deficits, and industry had been nationalized and completely run down. Margaret Thatcher realized that the first thing that she was going to have to do was correct the finances of the country, massively cut spending and raise some taxes. She knew this was going to have a deflationary impact on the economy. She also knew she was going to have to denationalize industries. And if you've got industries that have been pampered and you're suddenly making them pay their way, that too is going to have a deflationary effect. And she knew that what she had to do was fill the gap in industry. Right or wrong, she took the view the quickest way to fill the gap was to massively enhance the arms industry. Great Britain at that time was like the eighth largest arms exporter in the world. By the end of this decade, it was the second largest. Today, it is still one of the largest arms exporting countries in the world. One in five of every person employed in Great Britain is associated with the arms industry. 2 weeks ago, Keir Starmer, a Labour Party Prime Minister, signed the largest arms deal ever signed by Great Britain. The alarms industry is alive and well. At the same time, she realized that one of the ways to fill the gap in the public purse was literally to take her premier intelligence and military services and hire them out. We had tremendous military and intelligence infrastructure going back to the empire, but we no longer had an empire. So we had one of the best trained, best infrastructured military and intelligence services in the world, with, to be honest, nothing to do. At the same time, and I will come back to the Israel situation, Israel and United States through the CIA have had legislation passed which tied their hands. And there was a very easy marriage there. The Americans and the Israelis could ask the British intelligence and military services to do things that they couldn't do. And they got paid for it. It is as awful an end game, some game, as that. So that's the answer to that question. And I raised the point about Israel. After the Israeli establishment, even today, is very politically divided. So whether it's the Department of Agriculture, the Cabinet Secretary's Department, the military, or the intelligence services, it is all divided politically to keep the balance. Whatever may be going on in Parliament in terms of to and fro and protests against Netanyahu, that division is maintained within the bureaucracy and is rebalanced whenever there is an election. So that in 1972, when the Munich Olympic massacre took place, there was this division in the military and the intelligence services between the left wing and the right wing. The left wing wanted to keep the fight against Arabs and Palestinian Arabs to the Middle East. It says, our fight, this is where we keep it. The right wing said, this is not working. We just had 12 of our athletes killed in Munich. We need to take the fight abroad. We need, first of all, to find the Palestinians, Arab terrorist organizations, where they are, and defeat them. And at the same time, we need to use whatever devices we can to encourage Western governments to support Israel. And when I say devices, I mean things like political blackmail, bribery, and so on. And ARI, in that regard, was based in London, not just because of the city of London, but also because at that time, Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government was leaning towards the Arabs and the Palestinian Arabs in particular, and he was their primary target. So that's what you have going on in the 80s. How on earth does this relate to Russiagate and Epstein? Well, hundreds of millions of profits, dollars of profits, were being made out of illegal arms sales. They needed to be put somewhere. And ARI recruited Robert Maxwell. Robert Maxwell was a Czechoslovakian Jew, and he had been recruited for some time by Mossad. ARI Benjamin actually worked with Robert Maxwell to launder those profits into Eastern Europe. Robert Maxwell had strong contacts with Eastern European communist dictators. Although communist, they still needed to do business with the rest of the world. And they did that business through Robert Maxwell. Although communist, the people still needed to buy things, and they had raging black markets. And those black markets were run by the Russian and East European mafia, the mob. So ARI and Robert Maxwell were doing business with communist dictators and the Russian and Eastern European mafia to put those profits into Eastern Europe. Money laundering is a fairly specialized function, and that's where the subject of my book, a gentleman called Hugh Simmons, comes into play, because he was recruited by ARI and Robert Maxwell to do the laundering of the money from the profits back into Eastern Europe through ARI and Robert Maxwell, and also to senior British party politicians. He was very close to Margaret Thatcher. So that is what was going on in the 80s. How did I come across this? Because my friend Hugh Simmons turned up dead in some woods in 1988. There was no reason for it. There was money missing from his client, his law firm's account, but there was no reason for him to be dead. I started asking the right questions in the wrong places, got shot at, had weird meetings with Israeli intelligence in Montreal, CIA in London, and so on, and followed the trail, first-hand accounts and research, to where we are. Fast forward, we can come back and look at some of the details of this if you like, to the here and now. Let's start with Russiagate. What on earth has this got to do with this? It is indeed the case, and we now know this from both Durham and Mueller, that the Russians tried to influence the elections in 2016. The story that was put out at the time, and it still lingers, is that the only people that the Russians were trying to influence were Trump and his campaign. That's not true. The Russians were trying to influence four politicians in Washington. Well, aside from obvious reasons, why? A thing called the Magnitsky Act. Is that something that you've heard of? Okay.
No.
When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Boris Yeltsin took over, toyed with capitalism rather badly. Putin took over in 2000 and slightly amended capitalism in Moscow and corrupted it and made sure that he and his KGB, former KGB friends, were making money out of it. The rules that Putin had in Moscow were for Western investment firms to come to Moscow, they had to have Russian dictators and Russian directors. Those Russian directors had access to identities and bank accounts, and they would simply cream off of them and launder the money abroad. A gentleman called Bill Browder, who actually was a financial consultant to Donald Trump after Hugh Simmons, my friend, died, there's a connection there. Bill Browder came to Moscow in the early noughts and set up a company called the Hermitage Capital Management Trust, an investment firm. There were Russian directors, money went missing. Browder had a Russian accountant called Sergei Magnitsky. Sergei said, "These guys are taking out all your money. We need to report it." Bill Browder reported it. The Russian Department of the Treasury immediately accused Bill Browder of avoiding taxes. He fled the country. Sergei Magnitsky was put in prison, died in prison as a result of torture. Bill Browder goes around Europe and America complaining about this in 2012, unbeknown to me, sort of slipped under the radar. Congress passed an act called the Magnitsky Act to
No, I'm sorry,
punish
I missed that. What was the act?
the Magnitsky. It's Magnitsky Act. And the sole purpose of the act was to punish people associated with Bill Browder's firm, the Hermitage Land Trust, who had been involved in stealing money from the company and possibly involved in Sergei Magnitsky's death. Okay, the reason it was under the radar is, why does anyone care about this? The reason is because Putin received 50% of any and all monies being laundered abroad. So here's the Hermitage Capital Asset Management Trust, whatever. Not a very large company, but he received, was down for, 50% of the assets that were laundered abroad. As a result of the Magnitsky Act, all of his assets abroad could have been frozen. It is generally understood that Putin has about $70 billion of assets laundered abroad. So he was concerned about this. Much of what you see going on at the moment between Trump and Putin that doesn't seem to make sense doesn't make sense because one of the items on the agenda is Putin is still trying to protect his $70 billion worth of assets because the Magnitsky Act has never been repealed. What was going on in 2016, 4 years after the act was passed, was that Putin sent out his agents, lawyers, a team of them, to Washington to suborn any and all politicians they could find, to have them promise that they would repeal the Magnitsky Act. It wasn't just Trump. They approached Hillary Clinton. We know about the Steele dossier. They approached Trump. There was a famous meeting between Don Trump Jr. and Putin's agents in the Mayflower Hotel in Washington in June of 2016. Donald Trump Jr. is repeated, there's a record in one of the articles that I researched of him coming out of this meeting saying, "I have no idea what that meeting was about. To be perfectly honest, I thought there were people in there who had opposition research from Hillary Clinton. And there was this woman who is now named lawyer in there from Russia who spent half an hour with a slideshow telling me something about something called the Magnitsky Act. I have no idea what it is." That's what it was. Putin wanted it repealed to protect his assets. So why has this all been, why has that particular issue been re-raised now? Well, on the face of it, because Trump wants to embarrass Obama. I'm a little bit concerned because if you look into it, as I have done and others have done, you find this money laundering, you find this the possible involvement of Donald Trump in money laundering, and it doesn't make any sense, which in my mind, and I'm being purely speculative here, Dave, raises questions about where Tulsi Gabbard's loyalty actually lies. Because although there is potentially a story in the Russiagate expose, the danger is it's going to expose things that could be damaging to the Trump administration. And I wonder what Tulsi's ambitions are here, but that's purely speculative. Now, listeners may say, you almost had me, but I don't particularly understand why there's a connection between Donald Trump and this Putin money laundering. Small point. Most people have missed it. I came across it remarkably through CNN. The article is still up there. In March of 2017, after Donald Trump took power, Preet Bharara, who was the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, was sacked by Donald Trump. Everyone thought it was political. It wasn't. At the same time, Preet Bharara was about to negotiate a settlement in a small case under his jurisdiction. That case in New York was the end of the pipeline of the money from the Hermitage. In other words, money had been stolen from Hermitage, including Putin's share, sent through a pipeline, ended up in a bank in New York, and this was reported in CNN. And Preet Bharara was going to settle that case, and it would become known who was benefiting from the pipeline of money, and that it would have been, amongst other people, it would have been Putin. Donald Trump fired Preet Bharara and had his DOJ in his first administration shut down the case. No reason has ever been given for it. It may mean something, not nothing, but it is potentially a connection.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, and you've traced this pretty meticulously, but why wouldn't the Democrats expose this while they were in power?
Why would they or why wouldn't they?
Why wouldn't they?
To be perfectly honest, Dave, how much of what I've just talked about have you ever heard about before? Put a percentage.
I'm a little bit aware of it because I know it goes into Ukrainian arms sales and siphoning off money. I'm aware of that part of it. I know Hunter Biden was involved with his lackeys, but what you're getting into right now with Trump, I have not heard that as a direct accusation. So to answer your question, I
I
haven't,
think
but I just go back and I got to think, if I'm a Democratic strategist, I'm putting this out front and center.
I have my view about it, but in a sense, you've answered the question. This involves everyone.
Okay.
Everyone has been making money. So you know about Podesta in Ukraine. You know about the Bidens in Ukraine.
Yes.
Everyone gets involved. I'm surprised that, to be perfectly honest, Dave, I'm surprised that anyone is raising this. But Washington politicians are not known for being the cleverest people in the world. There may be a sense of scattershot about this, that if we raise it, enough mud will stick to the other side, and less mud will stick to my side. I have a, in terms of the actual timeline, my own personal view goes something like this. In 2015, 2016, for reasons I don't quite understand, right, probably because of what I was still tracing out of my book, Magnusland, it was published in 2015. I was particularly paying attention to what was going on in London and in Washington. And I was picking up on this whole BuzzFeed dossier, investigations into Hillary Clinton's emails, possibility of Russian collusion. And I followed it down, and perhaps more closely than some people, and none of it made sense to me. Law enforcement, then under the control of Obama, national security, then under the control of Obama, were releasing information. I kept saying to myself, why are you talking about these things? These are matters, whoever you think you're embarrassing, you shouldn't be releasing this information. It's supposed to be primary covert information. It's exposing the United States. And I couldn't understand it, so I followed it. This is how I found out about meetings by Donald Trump Jr. at the Mayflower Hotel. And the BuzzFeed dossier, as it was then became called the Steele dossier, came out. And an organization called the Democracy Coalition did an in-depth examination of the file and came to the same conclusion, that it was the Russians were not just targeting Trump, they were targeting everyone, scattershot, and almost everyone took advantage of it. Both Hillary, maybe the Trump administration, maybe the Trump campaign, maybe not. Certainly Hillary. And it tainted everyone. Why didn't there and then the Obama and his administration expose it more thoroughly? And the answer is they didn't believe Donald Trump was going to win. I was a Democrat. I was surrounded by people campaigning for the Democrats. And the primary view of Democrats campaigning on the ground was we don't need to do very much because he's simply not going to win. I was one of the few people, and I was living in North Carolina at the time, coming back and saying, you are not seeing, you are not speaking to people on the ground. Donald Trump is going to win. They didn't believe it. So I think the first thing is they didn't bother trying to expose it through opposition research because they didn't believe he was going to win. Then he won. Then you get into the territory of changing the intelligence. At that point, I think they did want to go after Donald Trump. But why didn't they think they were going to expose themselves? To be honest, Dave, I don't think they knew about it. I honestly don't think they knew about it. I don't think they knew about the depth of Podesta's involvement in the Ukraine or even the Biden involvement to Ukraine until much later. Why are they doing it now? I think you have this extraordinary power play going on in Washington and elsewhere. Everybody has fingers in the pie. I can help discuss what I think of the elements, but I can't. It's not clear cut. It's not black and white. There's no one good guy. There's no one bad guy. Is it corrupted intelligence agencies of the West and Donald Trump trying to clean house? Definitely, I think there's an element to that. I think it's genuine.
That's fair. Jeff, I've got something that might interest you. Back in 2016, early 2016, Obama and a whole plethora of officials brought over to the United States Ukrainian prosecutors. And I have the documents. There's no question this happened. And they were at various hotels and they were being educated on how to prosecute Burisma without ensnaring American politicians or their relatives. But I think it went deeper than that. I think it went deeper to cover what you're talking about.
I don't doubt that for a moment. And sensible people would say, wouldn't it be more sensible for both sides just to stay away from this altogether? And I think you've got a mix. You've got some people on both sides of the aisle who want to get to the truth. You've got some people on both sides of the aisle who want to hide the truth. And you've got people on both sides of the aisle who probably have their finger in the pie and they're making money out of it.
Interesting.
And at any given time, I'm going to back up here. I was told this by a British intelligence informant of mine as I was trying to figure this out. And he said, much like Harry, who was saying it's all about money and you're not factoring that in. My British intelligence informant said, you think it's all simple. You think it's black and white. It's not black and white. It's grey. He was speaking with me in the fall of 1989. The Berlin Wall came down in November of 1989. I started speaking to this informant in September of 1989. He was very forthcoming about what had happened to my friend, Hugh Simms, who is the subject matter of my book, Maggie's Hammer. And he had one story. And in that story, the CIA were trying to kill him, Reggie, my informant, up in Glasgow. He showed me an apartment that had been burned out, which is where he used to live. 2 months later, he's on the telephone to me and saying, the world has changed. The wall is down. The people who were trying to kill me yesterday today want to hire me because I can speak German in 17 different dialects and I can get money for them into Eastern Europe. Well, this blew my mind. I don't understand a world like that. And he said, when you are looking at intelligence activities, corrupt intelligence activities, money laundering, arms dealing, you have to look at it in that way. Things change. Just to go off on a tangent for a moment, I got involved because my friend Hugh Simms turned up dead in some woods in November 1988. I asked questions, I went where I went. I ultimately met Ari Ben-Menashe because Ari published a book in 1992 called Prophets of War. You don't want to buy that one, people. You want to buy mine, okay? So if you're small on budget, buy mine, then his afterwards. Anyway, he wrote the book in 1992, and Dave tucked away in the middle of this book was one paragraph. It said that in 1988, the Iran-Iraq war came to an end. Israeli intelligence had tolerated the sale of arms to Iran and Iraq throughout the decade because they were making money and it was keeping two of their foes killing each other. Why wouldn't they do that? Then the war came to an end and they wanted the arms dealing to stop, especially to Iraq, which under Saddam Hussein represented more of a proximate threat at that stage to Israel. Forget today, at that stage it represented the main threat. Iraq had ballistic missiles, which pretty much everyone has now, but at that stage they were one of the very few countries in the Middle East to have ballistic missiles that could get to Israel. So Iraq was the main enemy. Hugh at that time was primarily laundering money from arms deals in Iraq. That needed to stop. The paragraph that caught my attention was a paragraph in which Harry said that in November of 88, he had been tasked by Yitzhak Shamir, the Israeli Prime Minister, to set up hit squads to go into Europe to take out anyone involved in the pipeline of arms to Iraq and the money laundering out of Iraq. And I wrote to him and said, "Well, I believe that my friend was involved in that. Have you ever heard of him?" And Ari, out of the blue, contacts me and says, "We have his name on a list." I didn't recognize the name and I went and checked. He was one of the targets in November of 1988. I've actually become quite friendly with Harry, which is unusual. But to this day, he knows that I believe he was the one who ordered the death of Hugh Simmons, which is an unusual friendship to have. But that's how I got involved with Harry. And Harry, I said, "You were," after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing with him and lying by Harry. That's one of the problems you have to. Many of these sources lie about a lot of things, and we have to sort out what they're lying about, what they're telling the truth about. I finally managed to extract from Harry the information that he didn't just know about Hugh. He wasn't just on the list. Harry had actually been in business with Robert Maxwell and Hugh. And I said, "Well, I don't understand this. 1 minute you're doing business with him, and the next minute, not." And he said, "That's the way it changes. It's not black and white. And if there's anything that comes out of this, say, if there's no black and white, so if you look at Epstein and Russia data at the moment, it's not black
Yeah,
and white."
I'd like to ask a question and bring this into it. I'm kind of getting the sense, and I don't want to run out of time, so I want to make sure we bring in the second half of this. Epstein, is he connected to Israeli intelligence, and is that the connection to what you're talking about here?
Yes, it is. And ironically, maybe not ironically, Harry Behmanashi was the source of this information in another book back in 2019. Most people think of Epstein and they think New York, billionaire, political blackmail, maybe, and reprehensible sexual activity. But that's not where he got his start. According to Harry, and I've not talked to him about this, but it has about it the ring of truth because it paints the same picture that Hugh Simmons was involved with in the 80s. Epstein, then 30, not a billionaire, young, ambitious, went to London. Why London? Same reason everyone went to London in the 80s.
Yeah.
That's where all of it, this was all happening. He went to London. He was recruited by Ari Behmanashi. They were involved in arms dealing together. Epstein was introduced to a well-known British arms dealer called Sir Douglas Leese, who was behind a very large arms deal at that stage called Alyamama. It was a multi-billion dollar contract between Britain and Saudi Arabia that started in the 80s and is a rolling contract, so it continues to this day. Huge profits and illegal commissions and kickbacks paid out of Alyamama through Douglas Leese, through Ari, through Hugh. And Epstein was a part of this. Now, I can say my investigations have found no connection specifically between Epstein and Hugh, but there's no reason why they should be. They were compartmentalized to some extent. But Epstein was money laundering in London. He was engaged in arms dealing and money laundering. He was introduced to Robert Maxwell. There's documented proof that Epstein met with, interestingly enough, Robert Maxwell and Donald Trump in London at that time with an Egyptian arms dealer called Adnan Khashoggi.
What year was this?
This was, I don't have the year, I just have that it was in the late 80s.
Late 80s,
okay. And the other gentleman was Adnan Khashoggi, who was an Egyptian arms dealer, well known to anyone who studied Iran-Contra. He was one of the major arms dealers involved in that whole situation. I believe it is also the case, and that's a topic for another time, that Epstein was introduced to his sexual proclivities in London. He wasn't involved. Hugh Simmons wasn't involved. But Great Britain and London in particular have an unfortunate and long history of involvement in child sex and politicians. It is long documented. Some of your listeners may have read of some of the recent scandals in London involving the BBC and personalities that don't mean anything to Americans, people like Jimmy Savile, but it's been long documented. It may well be that's where Epstein was first introduced to that, but I don't know. But he was introduced to the rest of it. He then came back to New York, and although he started his political blackmail with Robert Maxwell's daughter, Ghislaine, who was also involved in money laundering in New York. Transactions have been found through Deutsche Bank linking Epstein again to the Russian mob seeking to launder money into New York. So he was part of what was going on in the 80s. It carried forward until he died in New York in 2019, I believe it was. And if you go and you look at Epstein, you potentially can find all of this other stuff. So when you hear that people want to release the files, do they know about this other stuff or do they not? When Donald Trump says, I've had a look at the files, I've been informed by Pam Bondi, I don't want to release the files now. Is it because of stuff that is linked to him? Or is it because, and I believe to some extent this could be true, he has looked at the totality of what Epstein was connected with, going back to the 80s, the arms dealing, the money laundering, the extent of the corruption of intelligence agencies, and says, this cannot become public. If this becomes public, what little trust the American people have in their government will disappear forever.
I would agree. And I have a corollary to add to this, and this is public knowledge. Going back to London and the Bank of London, there is a huge scandal right now, and it's being kept out of the mainstream media for the most part, but not entirely. But they're selling paper gold for which they have no gold behind it. And they're competing with hard gold industry, and it's totally corrupt. And I've been told this goes back into some of the Epstein, CIA, MI5 dealings, and also the Russians. I've been told they've all been involved in this. Is that true?
Well, I don't know about this, Dave. What I can say is it's rather like when I was looking, when Harry Berman actually came out with his allegations about Epstein, and he described what Epstein was up to in London. And it was as if he was describing, in financial and arms terms, what Hugh Simmons was up to in London in the 80s. And all I can say is it has the ring of truth to it. You have just mentioned something that is happening behind the scenes involving, what can we call it, dirty money, as a better word, as good expression as any. And it involves the same parties and the same elements that I'm talking about.
Exactly.
It started in the 80s, it's come forward, and those parties are still protecting themselves. And you and I can describe the elements. We may not be able to discover how it all balances out. I don't think people know how it balances out. This is what Ari said. This is what my British intelligence informant, we were talking about the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, one time. And he said, everybody's looking for a single sniper with a rifle. It doesn't work like that. He said, think of Diana and the tunnel. Think of JFK and the Dealey Plaza. What you do if you want to assassinate someone is you create a zone of opportunity, and you get out of that zone of opportunity anybody who might interfere, and you flood it with potential agents. At the time that Diana died in the Paris tunnel, in I can't remember the year, how bad, 1997, remembered. There were reputedly 150 MI5 agents in Paris who had not been there the week before. You flood the zone. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, you move on. It's not a single person taking a single shot. And this is, I think, is true with what's going on at the moment. There are many different elements involved in Epstein and Russiagate. They go back to the 80s. That involved arms dealing, money laundering, the Russian mob, corrupt intelligence agencies, and everyone is trying to get influence, a leg up. And if that takes down some of the opposition, or even some of your own people, if you come out of it at the end of the day ahead with money in your pocket, that's what you do. And then there's people like you and me and your listeners trying to work out why the headlines don't make any sense. But when you look behind the headlines, actually, it makes a rather terrible sense.
This is very interesting because you're painting a picture that Epstein, his primary dealings initially was not child trafficking. It was the arms business and it was also money laundering connected to that. I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around the hierarchy. Arms trafficking and the money laundering that goes on, does that lead to the spinoff of child trafficking?
Can I say this, Dave? And I invite your readers to do the same thing. And this is where my British intelligence informant, who was a guy called Reggie, tried to educate me, and Harry tried to educate me. Mentally, I had in my mind a notice board, and I think we still have them, and post-it notes and little thumbtacks. And I would get a bit of information, another bit of information, another bit of information, and try to make them match. And they just laughed at me and they said, it's not as simple as that. You're thinking one dimension. Think five dimensions. There is no hierarchy. There is just us out there stirring up trouble, trying to make money, trying to gain advantage. So at any given time, we're stirring up trouble, trying to make money for ourselves, trying to get some advantage for our own team. But there is no our team. The best intelligence agent is a double agent. We're feeding information to both sides so that both sides will give us information, and only we know who is our primary principal. And if we can come out of it with some money in our pocket, our primary principal slightly ahead, the other guy's slightly down, but everybody's maybe made something, then we're good. And I'm like, oh, and you are like, where's the hierarchy? There is no hierarchy. But where does the child trafficking come in? Okay, I want to add a caveat here, so we're all very clear. Child trafficking is abominable. It is reprehensible. What we are talking about here at the end of the day is power. And people who have power, particularly people who wield it behind the scenes and find cleverly that they can achieve things without people knowing, people like that give themselves permission to do anything. And I would characterize it like this, and I don't want people to think I'm minimizing it. I'm not. You go out and you spend your work day dealing arms, laundering money, trafficking whatever, making money, helping your principal intelligence agency. And in the evening, you go out and you have some fun and you give yourself permission to have whatever fun you want. And that fun can very often be child sex. It is as grim and it is as awful as that. I do not believe it is a primary activity. And except insofar as it can lead to political blackmail, it is a part of the wider story.
That's true. I've interviewed people like Nick Bryant that really lays out an excellent case that the Epstein material was to be designed to be politically compromising to some degree. I think there's no doubt about that too. You know, there's something else that occurred to me too. You're painting a picture that the arms trafficking and money laundering is pretty centrally controlled, and then you get the tributaries that come out from it. Have you come across a connection with the Chinese, the Mexican cartels, and the arms running and the child trafficking they do? Is this connected to the same group?
I have no indication of any.
Okay.
My investigation hasn't gone to China,
Okay.
nor has it gone to Mexico. The only thing about Mexico is going back to Iran-Contra. In addition to trading money for arms for the Contras,
CIA. Yep.
there was
Yep.
the CIA and drugs out of MENA, and it never formed a central part of my investigation. So I paid attention to it peripherally, but peripherally, for some reason, the center of drug activity seemed to move up from Latin America and Colombia to Mexico. That's all I know. It makes sense, but I never really understood the history of it.
Now, I can see you've painted a good picture why Trump doesn't want these files out. And I can think of the gold reason, because he's trying to go to more of a gold-backed situation in our country with our currency. And what's going on with the Bank of London could tear that up. And this would lead right to that if that all opened up. And then the other thing I can see happening here is the decades of collusion of the powers that be.
Yes.
And I can see now why the Democrats didn't try to expose this while they had control of the White House, because
Well,
they were involved deeply.
they were involved.
Exactly.
And as I say, and I know you wouldn't mind my saying it, where does my book Baggy's Hammer come into it? This is a book that started with the death of my friend, asking questions, following a trail. It's a pretty good read as an adventure story, but it ends up through first-hand contact with various intelligence agents, painting this bigger picture, which I honestly believed had come to an end at the end of the 80s, but I continued to follow the trail, and it worked its way through an expansion during the War on Terror into the current decade, and it's still here with us. And before we go, I'm not quite sure when we have to end. Let me give you one example of just how close, just how much it is still relevant today.
We got about 2 minutes left.
Okay. After the Conservatives left office, arms dealing and the corruption rising out of it, kickbacks to politicians continued into the Labour government and beyond. The first Labour government was that of Tony Blair. One of Tony Blair's primary lieutenants was a gentleman called Peter Mandelson, held various positions. He was also Labour Party's arms bag man. He was the one who negotiated the political kickbacks from the arms deals into the Labour Party. And he had close associations with an arms dealer called Wafik Sayed. Keith Starmer, about six prime ministers further along, just appointed Peter Mandelson, the British ambassador to Washington. It's still
Oh
here.
boy.
It's still with us.
Yeah. Continuance of activities, but also a way to cover up an investigation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. My audience is going to want to know how to follow you, because I think we've left a lot on the table because of time constraints. So, how do people follow your good work?
Either by buying the book, easy, Google Maggie's Hammer, Jeff Gilson with a G, not difficult to find. My primary source of up-to-date blog posts is on my Facebook page, which is totally public. Anybody can see it. And again, it's GEOFF, Jeff Gilson, Facebook, you'll find me.
Yeah, let me get that spelling out for your first name again. It's
It's
GEOFF.
GEOFF.
Right, Jeff Gilson on Facebook. And folks, I'm telling you, we've just opened up the can of worms. We haven't pulled the worms out yet, because there's some things we've left on the table. But fascinating, fascinating stuff, Jeff. As things come to more light, and this isn't going to go away, because people like me are going to continue to dig and pry, and you're going to dig and pry, and more stuff's going to come out. I'd like to have you back on to talk about it.
Lovely. We'd be delighted to come back, Dave.
Our guest has been Jeff Gilson, and he's been associated with the Centers of Power in the UK. And you have heard some stuff that we've covered here on this show, but a whole lot more. And I think this is just the opening chapter, and this isn't going to go away. And I don't think Trump can run from this. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Great to have you on.
My pleasure.